Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome, 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 welcome back. I've been on vacation. I'm so happy to be back and to kick this show off with, oh my goodness, a best-selling author that you are just going to absolutely love meeting today. For those of you who are tuning in for the first time and for our many, many listeners who tune in every week, I thank you and welcome you to Blog Talk Radio's Off the Shelf for this Saturday, August the 7th, 2010. I thank you so much for joining us. Truly a joy to have you here. And for those of you who are just tuning in for the first time, I'd like to introduce myself. I'm your host, Denise Turney, coming to you live from the city of brotherly love, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. And again, and I can't say it enough, I thank you for your support, and I encourage you not to let another day pass before you pick up a copy of Long Walk Up. It's my latest book. It's a powerfully moving, inspirational book that you need to add to your book collection. And you can pick up a copy of Long Walk Up today by visiting www.chistell.com. You can also pick it up at any bookstore, Borders, Walmart, Amazon.com, and if you don't see it on the shelf, just ask the store clerk for it. And now, let us meet our special guest here on Off the Shelf this morning. She is a prolific writer, and I do mean that in every sense, with an entrepreneurial spirit. She is author Michelle McGriff. Michelle McGriff is the author of several books, including Swerve, Blood Relations, Last Breath, For Love's Sake, Destiny's Song, A Style of His Own, Obsession 101, and I read that one, and Majestic Secret. Michelle is a native Californian. She is a teacher and a lover of good literature. And although she and I haven't met in person, we've known of each other for several years. Her talent is obvious. I have read her works. I know she is good. And we are honored to have her on Off the Shelf this morning. Please visit Michelle McGriff. She's a best-selling author online at www.michellemcgriff, and I'll spell that, MichelleMcGriff. Again, www.michellemcgriff.com. Welcome to Off the Shelf, Michelle.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. It's been a while.
Yeah. Yes, and I think this might be the first time I heard your voice. We've emailed each other and we've chatted over the years, and I've certainly read your work and have enjoyed your work, and it's just an honor to finally connect with you over the phone and here at Off the Shelf. I truly am happy, coming back from vacation, to have you kick off the second half of the year for us here at Off the Shelf. And I know our many listeners are really going to be delighted with you. You have been so busy, as I was telling you even before the show launched this morning, with the numerous books that you have written. And it had been a while since I had checked out your website. And when I did the research for this interview, I was like, wow, she is really on the move. Oh, my goodness. I remember when I first met you, you had published Obsession 101.
Right,
and, to further introduce you to our off-the-shelf listeners, could you tell us how old you were, Michelle, when you started writing, and what inspired you to know that you were a writer?
Well, I started writing in high school at about 13, 14. But before then, I actually told a bunch of stories. But actually being able to pin it on paper, I had read, you know, T.S. Hilton's That Was Then, This Is Now. It was one of the readings we did in high school. They really pushed reading a lot more when I was in school. I'm not sure how they're doing it now so much. My grandchildren are really little, and they still have the summer reading program, so I know literacy is still really important. But we had to read all the time. I mean, that was one of the first things they did, was give us a library. I still have my first library card that I got in first grade, that they marched us down that library and got us library cards, and we, you know, would check out the maximum books. So I read T.S. Hilton. Hinton, I think it's T.S. Hinton, I think I'm still saying it wrong, That Was Then, This Is Now. And that book inspired me so much to say, wow, that was a great story. I think I can write something too. Mm-hmm. And I actually wrote my first book. It was 60 pages. I wrote it by hand. And it was the premise of what Majestic Secret is now.
Wow. How old were you when you started? You were like 15 when you started?
I was about 14 when I wrote that book.
Oh, my goodness.
And it got submitted to a house by a friend of mine. I didn't know anything about, you know, the literary industry,
mm-hmm.
and she submitted it. And they wrote back, and, it was rejected. It was too short, and et cetera, et cetera. But they wrote back and said, this was an exceptional quality of a girl your age. Continue to write. And that, kind of paraphrasing what they said, but it wasn't just that we don't want it. They actually realized my age and acknowledged it. And I don't even remember the house. I know it was a major house. But that editor took the time to say, you could do this. Just keep going.
Mm.
Go ahead. No, I was going to say my relationship with editors are very special because of that. Because my first experience with an editor was one that saw in me my potential and wanted me to reach it.
You know what I was getting ready to say for our listeners, and kudos to you, Michelle, is that when, a lot of times they do form letters, they just send you a form letter back in the mail. But when you get a personalized note from an editor or publisher, it shows that they did, there was something about your story that grabbed them and it was able to engage them as a reader. And that is a very good sign. And we know that you've done marvelous things since then. You already just told us the title of your first piece that you wrote and what it was about, which was my next question that I was going to ask you. Michelle, because you are such a prolific writer, and again, I'm going from when our paths first crossed, when I read Obsession 101, your story there, and to now, I'm like, wow. And I knew the last couple of years when I had connected with you, you writing like several books a year, if I remember correctly. When I went to your website and I saw all your titles, I was really blown away. I wanted to ask you, being a prolific writer, do you stick to a schedule? And like you write at a certain time, you say, I'm going to write from 9 to, 1 every day. Or do you say, I'm going to write a certain amount of hours a day? How do you keep yourself focused and on schedule so that you finish as many books as you do?
Well, in the turn of the economy, I think a lot of writers have had their writing schedules changed and adjusted because the publishing and printing schedules have changed and adjusted to because it is a market, it is a business. And so depending on how your books sell or how they're presented is how they're put in the queue. So because I am a mainstream writer now, my books aren't coming out as often as they were before.
Mm-hmm.
So my schedule isn't as full as it was before. I still write, but a lot of things aren't necessarily going to print as they are written. So it doesn't seem as though I'm writing as much. I get out maybe one book to two books a year, depending on if they're using my pen name as well. So there's not as many books coming out by me. So a lot of people have kind of like, oh, you're still writing? Yeah, I'm still writing. They're just not coming out as fast as they were before, which is, that's business. So in the interim of that, now I've gone back to school, which a lot of people knew too. I'm pursuing my PhD in organizational
management. Yes, go ahead.
Yes, I'm real excited about that. So I do a ton of writing. I do a gob. If that's a nice scholarly word. I do a gob of writing. But a lot of it's academic writing now, and it's in a different area. So yes, I do have to be really focused because now I'm writing, and I'm also a freelance writer for Demand Studios or Demand Media. I think they changed their name back to Demand Media, and that's going to take me back to conversations about editors. But so I have to be focused because now my brain has to be divided between academic writing, technical or business writing, and then fiction writing. And so, and those are very different because one requires a lot of fluff and one requires no fluff at all. And the other one requires this language that nobody really understands except instructors and professors that you're writing it for, So you have to be careful not to put those words into your fiction so that your fiction writers aren't having to pull out a dictionary of the other word. And, you have to really be creative about how you split that up.
What are you majoring in?
It's business and technology, so the degree will be in organizational management.
Okay.
And I'm not a corporate person, so it seems a little odd for me, but
you use it in some way. Maybe you get a job where you can make good material for a novel. Can you talk to us about the novel creation process for our listeners here at Off the Shelf who might want to they're thinking about writing their very first novel, Michelle, and they don't maybe don't know yet how to go about that. Can you talk to us about the novel creation process? When you sit down to write, do you like create an outline? Do you do character sketches before you start? How do you organize and create a book length story?
Well, I'm going to give you a little scenario. Like, for instance, with me, I'm not a corporate person, but my degree is in corporate, so it takes me into the corporate world a lot on the outlining that I plan to teach in corporate. I plan to teach managers to be managers or teach business administration. But in the interim of that, I meet people who are corporate people who say, I want to write a book, and they just don't know how to transition one life to the other. Well, what you can do is you take bits and pieces of your everyday life, and you fictionalize it. You can go internally, which would probably come out with a first-person story, or you can go externally, which will have you doing a third-person story or a story that's I just abbreviated omni, which means you know what's going on in everybody's heads, and you're able to organize that on the page. Me, I'm a character writer. I'm a people watcher. I've always been. I go to the mall, and I watch people, and I see what they do, and I ask myself, what if? When I see a person rushing through a crowd, what if they're trying to drop off some ransom money? I see a mother looking over her shoulder, and I think, what if she's really stolen that baby? You know, and I just draw up these really over-the-top scenarios about real people that I see. But mm-hmm. with that, I also see that person. I see what they're wearing. I see their shoes. I see their hair. I see their eyes. I see the way their eyes dart. I see the way their skin, if it's smooth, if it's not smooth. And I draw up a character. So that is my first step. When you're a creator when you're a writer, you create a planet, which is fine. And some people are really good at creating that planet. I'm so-so with the actual scenic, you know, like, oh, the leaves were green. You know, I was teasing some friends yesterday about a new title I want about sun-bleached trees. And that's just an observation of mine of looking out at the dark plum tree and noticing that the leaves looked bleached by the sun. Mm-hmm. And just that turn of a phrase, sun-bleached trees, draws up a vision for some people. And they can create a whole scenario about that. And then once I create the foundation, you know, in my mind or on paper with little notes, because like I wrote down, sun-bleached trees, warm, balmy breezes blowing through laced peignoirs. Okay, that's my visual. Now I have to put people in that. And you can't just start writing Harry, Mary, Jane, Susie. Those people have to have meaning or they can't be in the story, which mm-hmm. that's one thing people learn as writers, that editors will come in and go, who is that person and why are they there? And you fall in love with these people, and they're coming in like, you know, Friday the 13th, get them out of here, you know, get these people out of here, you know, left and right. You're left with like two or three people, and you're like, oh, my God. But you have to find really important people to move your story forward. And one thing I learned when I've only taken one or two actual writing classes because I wanted to, you know, hone in on some craft, you know, hone in on the craft and see what was really going on. I knew I could tell a story, but telling it, you have to learn how to write. So I thought, well, I should take a class and see if I'm even on the right track with writing. And what my instructor did was she showed movies. And I'm a movie person. I love movies. I won't say I'm a movie buff because trivia, I'd lose that if I love watching them anyway. I don't know who anybody is, but I watch it. And I watch it for the character. I watch for the characters that are portrayed and why they made it into that story, why they were given the lines they were given and why they were given the dialogue they were given and put in the scenes they were put in. You can tell when the movie is transitional, when they just didn't have anybody else to do that scene, so they threw somebody in to carry that move, to transition it into the next phase. Mm-hmm. And we learned to really tear apart a movie from, and then I took a film class, which, you know, it seems like you're getting further and further from writing, but you really aren't. When you take a film class, you watch the movie from the director's point of view. And then you realize you're the director. Mm. You decide what colors go in. You decide what that reader tastes and what they see and what they hear and what they feel when they read your book. And there's one author I know that I always laugh about the fact that when he writes, you can taste the dirt. You can smell the fear on people. And that's what you want. You want when the readers read your book and that character goes into a restaurant, you want to go, I remember the taste of that. You want them to feel that.
They have the emotions that the character's feeling. in a scene, if it's a scary scene or a romantic scene, you start to feel those emotions as well. That definitely is important. And like you said, if you create these characters you fall in love with, but they don't fit in the story, then it's difficult as a writer, but you should take them out in some dialogue or a scene to come out. Can you give us a brief synopsis? We want to talk about your books. Can you give us a brief synopsis of Swerve?
Swerve is a new genre for me, in a sense that it's a new public genre for me. I've been writing on this book, or this series of books, for going on, 6 or 7 years now. I actually wanted to write a spy book. I wanted to bring back 007 and my idea of a 007. And because I'm a people watcher, I wanted to put them in a suburban neighborhood. Now, funny enough, so did a lot of people on television now, because all these shows are coming out now. And I thought, oh, rats, I'm always right behind Mark. But it's been a few years ago that I actually started.
That has happened to me a couple of times. Go ahead, but that has happened.
Yeah, I think every author, and I believe them now. In the old days, you'd hear people go, that show that's on TV? I wrote that. And you'd go, yeah. Now that I'm a writer, I actually go, that was my title. My idea. And you realize they weren't lying. They really weren't lying. But the thing is that there really isn't anything new. There really isn't anything new under the sun.
Right.
You have to do is put your personal twist on it so that your readers go, that's Michelle McGriff. Yeah, that's Denise Turner. Yeah. That's her. All right.
Go.
And that's what you have to do. So with me, with Swerve is actually a prequel to the main story that I've been working on for years. After I created the book, I went in it and realized I had all these wonderfully juicy characters in there that I really couldn't develop within the main book. So I thought, there's such rich characters, I'm going to have to introduce them in their own books and then bring them to this one book. And so that's what led me to Swerve. Swerve is the introduction of one of the characters.
That is a very interesting concept. Wow, I never heard of anybody doing that before. Very interesting.
Because when I write, I just write. And that's what I tell when I do have a student. I usually teach them some virtual classes. I'm dying to get in an actual classroom and teach a full classroom. But I usually teach one-on-one. I'm a mentor and a coach. I teach my mentees, just write. Don't worry about any kind of formatting or anything. Just when you ask me if I do an outline, no. That takes too long. And I tell them just to write into your head. Get the story out of your head.
Okay.
Because if you don't, you'll never finish. And I have one mentee that she rewrites and rewrites and rewrites, and it really is stifling to her. And when she finally just wrote, she actually finished her first piece. And I won't say it's because of me, but I know I've always hounded her about that.
Right.
Just write it. And so she wrote it. And then go back and find the good, find the nuggets.
Absolutely.
Find the nuggets.
Mm-hmm.
So, mm-hmm.
No, I just wanted you to tell us. So, what Swerve? It brings together a group of characters you've introduced in other books that you've been writing for 6 to 7 years. Without giving the whole story away, can you let our readers know some one or two key things that help to drive the storyline in Swerve forward?
Well, in Swerve, I think the main character, Romia, I think she's going to be a very strong female character. I know when I did Color Summer, a lot of people enjoyed reading about Emma because I don't always draw up a strong female character. I generally draw up a strong male character. And so in Color Summer, it was a very strong female character, Emma. Well, I think in Swerve, Romia is going to be another strong female character. She's a police officer who's very within herself. A lot of people don't know much about her. And so that already gives her a sense of mystery. And she finds out, but you're actually following her, and you're realizing why she's the way she is, finding out what's brought her to the point she is in life. And then something happens. She's framed for murder. And that part I can't give away. It happens right away. She's framed for murder. Now, what happens from there on out is what I add. There's always that subtitle on your book. The book is called Swerve, A Turn of Unexpected Events. And that's what happens to her after that, A Turn of Unexpected Events.
Okay.
That she finds out not only about her life, but about herself.
Wow.
And I think that's where I differ from a little bit of the ones that are going on now about these some of the spy things that are coming out now.
Okay, sounds interesting. Sounds interesting, Michelle. Can you tell us about For Love's Sake? And before you do, I want to give our listeners here at Off the Shelf your website URL again so they can go over, check out your website, check out your books while we are actually doing this interview live. And Michelle McGriff's website is, again, www.michellemcgriff, and that's spelled M-I-C-H-E-L-L-E. mcgriff.com. Again, michellemcgriff.com.
Yes,
you can go check out her book while even actually as you listen to her discuss these titles that we're going to talk about. We're not going to talk about all her titles. She has written several books, but I do want to talk about a few of her books on today's show. For Love's Sake is one of your earlier books. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. For our off-the-shelf listeners who aren't familiar with For Love's Sake, could you please tell us about a little bit about For Love's Sake without giving the whole book away?
Well, For Love's Sake is a 20-something book. It's a book, well, I think they're 30-somethings. And it's they're kind of traveling through life without a care in the world. They're a group of college friends and family who've been really successful in their careers. They've kind of got through a little bit of drama, but then they felt that they were kind of untouchable, basically. And even the way they dealt with their relationships, they were very self-centered and they wanted what they wanted out of that relationship and weren't really necessarily a giving group. Even though you really like them, there's nothing bad about them. They're just very typical. And then one person in the group has a change of life and the others have to make decisions about rallying to this one character's aid, supporting her, agreeing with her decision, and going along with it. And then while that's happening, they each reflect on their own life and what's going on in it. And in one instance, one of the characters has a traumatic incident that occurs. That character is the one that carried over into Obsession 101.
Ah.
And then after that, I think I mentioned to you in an email before, I was doing a sequel to that, which was Blood Relations. And so that one character carried over into Blood Relations, Obsession 101 and Blood Relations.
Okay, I read Obsession 101, I truly enjoy. And your characters, they're very realistic people. They have, of course, their positive and their negative qualities. I know there was a guy in the book, and I know you said you generally in your stories the male is the strong one, and you have in your latest books introduced strong females into the story. But I know there was a guy in a story that I read of yours, and I think it was Obsession 101, who was mistreated, and I felt for this guy. And that was it was odd when I read it. I'm like, wow, Michelle is approaching this differently. Generally, it's the female who's getting mistreated, but he was like a nice guy, but he wasn't, he definitely wasn't like a player type of guy. And to see him get mistreated, the type of guy women tend to say that they want, and then he's the one who actually got played. But then there's a group of people in the story, and they are very close, and they have similarities, and then they also have differences, which makes their grouping together interesting. That's what
remember. It's a group of sisters. There's six sisters. So in that dynamic, you're going to get a lot of differences, because even though they're the same mother and father, these six women were very different.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually there's been a story that has featured each of them. I haven't completed the whole series with them either. But like Feels Like Falling, which is one of my unsung books, it's a lot of people haven't read that one because it deals with such a hard topic, which is cancer. That deals with one of the sisters and her fight with the stages of grief. And anyone that's going through that, I always recommend them reading it. When I have a friend that I find out is dealing with something hard, like a disease or a sickness, I usually send them that book. And so far they've all read it and said that this really was helpful to follow this character through the four stages of the five stages of grief.
Wow. I think that's important. Yeah, to see a character go through it. I think that's very healing. When you see somebody either in a movie or a poem or a story going through what you're going through, it makes you know that you're not alone and what you're feeling
exactly.
is not, so strange. So I think
especially
that's,
if the author is able to do it, if the author is able to write it realistically and not just gloss over it. I mean, you really can't write. I mean, I had to shed a lot of tears while writing this book because you really can't write it from a textbook perspective, like saying it's going to be okay, just go for a walk. You really have to realize that it's hard to go for a walk, or it's hard to eat food, or it's hard to breathe sometimes when you're suffering and when you're in pain. And in this instance, the character's faced with something that apparently seems so simple. Like for instance, if you were okay and you found out about an affair, you would handle it differently. Mm-hmm. But if you find out about an affair and the situation is grievous, is it still important? You know, where are your priorities in life? And that's what this book is talking about. Where are your family priorities?
Well, very, 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 very interesting and thought-provoking, the way you just put that. Did you find that each of your books that you wrote in the Majestic series, because there was another author that we had on here, she was a romance author, actually two romance authors, and they said that doing a series of books is a great way to build your audience. It's just an excellent way for an author to build their audience. Did you see that happen with your book series, the Majestic series? Did you see your readership grow with each new book you put out in a series?
Yes, with the Majestic series, and because I didn't do it right, I kind of shanghaied my readers because I was new at writing, and my books really did go in order. You couldn't move forward without reading the previous one, which is not fair, but I didn't know any better, and so that's how I wrote that series. And so people had to keep reading them in order. And so I really did shanghai a lot of people who got into the characters and enjoyed them. And it was great because they did appreciate that. And so when they moved into the For Love's Sake series, those books can be read out of order. And they appreciated that better, but yet they still liked the fact that it was a series. The characters were rich. I invented a city. In the Bay Area, I kind of put a fake town in the middle of the Bay Area, and that's where I place all my characters. Even my pseudonym, her characters live there as well.
Okay.
And some of the characters, some of the people will cameo back and forth, like when you see NYPD Blue and NCIS, and sometimes you see the characters from one show go to the other. That's what I wanted to do because I like TV so much, and I like the way that looks on TV. I wanted it to work in my books, too. And so I've created X amount of people. Each book introduces at least one new character, but most of my books have the same people kind of floating through.
Okay.
You know, I've got my police officers, I've got my teachers, I've got my bad guys, I've got my menaces to society, I've got my quirky people, I've got my urban people, I've got my snooty people, you know, and I just kind of evolve them into each story in unique ways. And it really helps the readers because they don't have to get to know new people every time they pick up a book.
Ah, yes. It's almost like if you're watching a soap opera or,
yes.
Not,
yes.
Like you said,
yes.
And you can. You can build an audience of loyal book followers as you create a series book. I've heard other authors say that is a great way to build your audience is to create series books. And like you said, you introduce maybe one or two new characters in each of the stories. It's a style of his own, Michelle. Is that one of the first or earliest books that you wrote that speaks from a male point of view?
Yes, because Majestic Secret was my first book out there, and that book was very character driven, and it got into everyone's head, and there really wasn't a lead because the main character wasn't alive through the whole story. And so everybody was living their life based on this character that wasn't living anymore. And it had a strong male voice, but a female one had a female narrative over the top of it. You see what I'm saying? It was like it had a female canopy over the top of the story. And then everyone was reacting underneath it. So when I wrote A Style of His Own, which was the second book, it was definitely a male point of view because it was a male story. And then Destiny's Song was the female story. It was kind of like they were counterparts.
I've got to ask you, being that you are a female yourself, how were you able to get into create a male character so that you could, I mean, being that, you know, we're women, we're not men, to create a character that is authentically male and thinks like a male? How did you talk to other men who were
I talked to males when I first started writing these books. I had just gotten onto the internet, and as most women know, which, you know, I guess I was kind of like, and I didn't realize it. You know, as soon as you come on the internet, men start popping up and talking. It's like free internet dating. I wasn't aware of that. I didn't know that that's what people did on the internet. I'd never been on the internet. Mm-hmm. And I was also married at the time, so that hadn't crossed my mind that that's what was going on. So I immediately met a lot of men on the internet. Mm-hmm. And I'm very, you know, I have some brothers and I have a lot of male cousins, and I never was one of those kind of girls that, I don't know how to put this on the air, how the guys really went for. I'm kind of goofy, right. And so I never really was really had a lot of sex appeal. So when guys met me, they usually liked my best friend. Okay. So I was able to get a lot of information out of guys because they usually didn't like me. They liked my best friend. So when I started meeting these men online, I went at it very friend-like. And so I would ask them tons of questions, and pretty soon they all realized, oh, well, she's not here to date. She really is here to talk. And they just would give me all this information after information. And it was great because there's a lot of them are still my friends today, and they know I'm just me, you know, and they come at me really real, and we're very honest with each other. And they still like my best friend. So, but overall, it's like, and then on top of it, when in the finishing of the book, I was going through a really nasty divorce. And then trying to find peace within that, mm-hmm. I started trying to see things from his point of view.
Ah.
And that helped me come to peace with without putting myself down, because I knew I am an average woman and I make average mistakes. I don't do anything drama. I'm not story worthy, but just in life in general. And so I try to take what he must have been wanting and put that into a character, even though some of it was selfish and whatnot, which is what I felt, just even trying to justify that. And then I have a son.
That is amazing that you would even do that. I'm sitting there blown away.
It's very difficult to be that honest. It's very difficult.
Oh, my goodness. That speaks volumes about you, that you were, you know, going through a divorce and you want to say, let me see if I can understand this from the other person's perspective. That speaks a lot about you. I don't know if I've ever heard another writer even say that they even thought about doing that.
Hear a person say, I love you, and yet you both are still in so much pain, and your first thought as a human being is to say, no, you don't, or you do this and that. And they go, yes, I do. I had to stop and think, why does he keep saying he loves me? Why does he keep saying that? It's obvious he doesn't. So I had to go back in the mind. I had to try to put myself in his shoes and say, why does he say that?
Mm-hmm.
What is he really saying to me?
Mm-hmm.
And develop a character based on that. And then looking at my son, you know, when you have a son and they, you know, they love you, but they'll stomp on you and kick you in the leg or whatever when they're little. And you think, how can you be loving me? Look how you're acting. And then you go into his head and you realize what he's really doing and what he's really saying, you know, and what he really wants. And all the men are these grown-up boys. And so you just have to grow that up and put it into a male character and realize what he's really saying.
Wow. Oh, my goodness. A style of his own. I love the title of it and what you've just put around the story and some of the things that might even have helped to inspire or led you to write this story. Very, very interesting. A style of his own.
Because when people read it, the first thing they said was, Devin is such a big old baby. But everybody felt sorry for him and kept reading it. But, you know, my sister read the whole series, and he kept reappearing in different stories, and she'd go, and then the big baby comes in. But she kept reading him, and she kept wanting to help him, and she kept, you know, cheering him on. And then she'd get down and go, because he's such a big old baby. And in a way, he is. But you can't help but want to help him, you know.
Yeah. Okay. I love that title and the concept of the story, and I'm sure our listeners hear it off the shelf. A style of his own. I really like that. When I was at your website, Michelle, researching for this interview, and I looked at Blood Relations, the book covers. Your covers are very, very eye-catching, very eye-catching. And when you spoke at the start of the interview about television and being, you know, working as a director, and as a writer, you're the director, I can see that you see things also as you are writing. That said, and talking about your book covers, Blood Relations, I looked at it and I said, is that a vampire book?
I know, a lot of people think that because it's another book called Bloodline or something. Yeah.
It looked like it. I said, wow, now she's going into sci-fi. Moving into
No. Even though Romia Swerve, after they read it, now I haven't gotten back the final edits from the. It's gone through content editing, but it's got to get the final on it before it goes to the printer. And I'm curious to see where they're going to put it on the shelf. And I'm really hoping it doesn't go into the paranormal shelf, because it does touch on some area, because I'm not a paranormal writer by any means. I don't write that at all. And I'm really worried that they might put it there, because it really is not paranormal. But it does touch on some tuitional and extrasensory type characteristics that the character has.
Okay.
And that she's grown to depend on since the death of her mother. So,
okay.
But it doesn't, it's not, but all my characters have that. Even if you look at Feels Like Falling, that character went into some intuitive things that her mother had taught her. And at one scene, in order to impress that on the reader that that's what she was doing, I actually showed her mother in the room, and her mother was dead. Well, her mother wasn't in the room, and it wasn't a ghost-type scene. It was the character giving into her memory of things her mother had taught her. And she was so intense that it was as if her mother was in the room.
Okay.
And so that's what I'm doing in this instance, that this character just falls on a lot of instinctive intuitivism and intuition, I should say, and that's what she relies on really heavily. But
do you pick the covers, the book covers?
No, I don't. Like the new book Swerve, new cover that's out there. My first time seeing it was on the internet.
Get out of here.
And one thing that people, when you first get started and you're with a smaller house, you actually get more input. You know, when you first get started and you're new, you get a little bit more input. You get to choose and pick and choose, and it depends on who the cover designer is. But it's as you get on deeper into it and you become kind of a household name at the house, they kind of know your style, and they know what you'll like, and I think the character designers just kind of go with what they know you'll like. And so, like with Blood Relations, when that cover came, it was just like, wow, I love it, because it represents one of the crazy characters in the book. And I thought, that's super. And so they kept it. And then when I got Swerve, the first one they gave me, it was okay. I mean, it wasn't like, and you can't, I try not to be difficult. You can't win them all. And it's like, it's okay. You know, I kind of thought it would show a little bit more action and maybe put Romeo on her motorcycle and, you know, all that kind of stuff, because that's really prominent in the story, the fact that she's a motorcycle rider. And she wears an emblem of a phoenix on the back of her jacket. So I kind of thought it would be a little bit more action-driven on the cover, because I am moving into the action genre. But it is a market. And I think my first book, I don't know what all went into it, but it doesn't show a lot of action on the cover, and that could have been purposeful. And
then
they redid the cover. I didn't know they were redesigning the cover until I saw it on the internet. And so, frankly, now the cover really doesn't expose very much about the story at all. If you look at the cover, in my thoughts, you don't have a clue what the story is about.
Oh, I got to tell you, because I've heard other authors say that you don't get a decision when you work with a book publisher. You really don't have much of a voice in what the cover is, because I guess they have their marketing teams, and they spent years. They know what will cause a reader to pick up a book and purchase it.
Exactly.
Just from the cover alone, and I guess that's the.
They work with color, and they work with. It's just like, that's why I remember I was going back to the design, the directors of movies. That's where you're working with the editor so closely, or a book designer so closely, because they're like the directors of a movie. They know how to use, they're supposedly knowing how to use that color. They know how to use the font. They know how to make sure the spine is such, because most books go on a shelf spine out. And that spine has to be such to make that book distinctive on a shelf.
Mm. Yeah. You got to do everything in your power because you've got a lot of competition to cause a reader to choose your book over hundreds of thousands of other books in the store. Before we talk about writing a little bit more and publishing, for our listeners here who would love to become like you, a published author, I want to talk about Destiny's Song. We just briefly touched on the fact that, and I'm still surprised that you didn't even see the cover of one of your latest books until you saw it on the internet. I love the title, like the title of A Style of His Own. I love your titles, Majestic Secrets.
Now those covers I had total control over. Those titles I had total control over. Those are my earlier work, and I won't say they're self-published. They were print on demand.
Okay.
And so I actually had to send the concept to the cover designer and get it designed, and I could approve or disapprove.
Okay.
I got several rounds with that. Those books were earlier. And so, yes, those covers were mine, my idea, my concept.
What, can you tell us before we go in and talk a little bit about how our listeners could one day be sitting where you're sitting as a published author? Before that, I want to talk about one more book of yours. Could you talk to our listeners about Destiny's Song and give them a brief synopsis of what that book is about?
Okay, Destiny's Song, in that whole series, I'm going to tell you right off the bat, Rested Memories is my favorite book. But Destiny's Song comes right before that. And for people that have read the series is quite old, so I don't mind giving away some of the story because in some of the reviews they do let it out. It is the one of the storylines is a May-December relationship where the girl is very young and the man is quite mature. And that's Jimmy and Destiny. And in that, I try to draw up the dynamics of young women thinking. She's in her 20s and how young women think. And he's in his 40s and how older men think. And bringing those two together. And Jimmy is a musician. And he's not a bad guy. He's just typical. And in this storyline, they're trying to work out their relationship and what happens is his actions are misunderstood by this young girl, and he has to win back her love, so to speak. He has to win back her love, and it's difficult because he also was in love with her mother before she died. And so trying to love her for who she is, basically giving her own song. And that's what, it's a very mushy romance about love, about finding love and accepting people for who they are. And in this case, age-wise, not so much status-wise, but bringing that generation gap together, bringing that age gap together.
Wow, man, you really know how to put a twist into your stories, which makes them very interesting and intriguing. I remember the story of yours that I read, and I tell our listeners here off the shelf, if you read one of Michelle McGriff's books, you will not be disappointed. You will not be bored and going ho-hum. Her storylines will keep you reading and turning the pages and try to figure out how in the world is this going to end. And I will say this, the first story that I read of yours, I even asked you, are you going to continue the story?
Yes.
I think you said you had thought about it, because when you finish reading one of your books, you're like, this could go on. This could go on.
Well, Section 101 did go on. Everybody was so upset with me for not, you know, doing anything with the bad guy that it did go on. That's what Blood Relations is. Blood Relations is the sequel to Obsession 101.
Okay, and so that's how your stories end, and there's so much that goes on, not to the point where the reader feels like there's too much happening in the story, but just enough to keep you sitting on the edge of your seat, and I like that about your style of writing.
Well, there are some, like Deadly Tease, that was one, we call it The Ugly Baby, that was my darkest story, and it sold really well, and it's kind of action-packed. It was one of my first action stories. And it's about a murder that happens in the red light district, and it's happening from the people in that district's point of view.
Okay.
So, you know, most of the characters are transvestites or prostitutes, and it's just the red light district, crack, you know, drug addicts and things, and how they handle a serial killer in their neighborhood. So it's got a lot of dark comedy and things like that. And I kind of, you know, once I got into it, I actually kind of enjoyed writing it, but a lot of people read it and went, woo, you know, and so, you know, I got the mixed reviews on it. And that's okay. You know, so like you say, some people do read my books and go, whew, that's a lot. And other people who like a lot happening, they enjoy it. They enjoy it.
Well, I didn't think that there was too much going on in the story, but it definitely made me want to know how the story, what was going to happen to these characters, what would be the final outcome of all that had happened so far to the characters, what would it culminate into? That was what I kept me going to interested in reading the stories of yours that I have read thus far. I wanted to ask you, Michelle, we kind of touched on this a little bit earlier as we come down to the last 15 minutes of today's show. How did you land your publisher? And kudos to you. I know you said you started out with your earlier books. They were print on demand. But I wanted to ask you, how did you land your publisher? And what advice would you give to new writers who are trying to be published? Would you suggest to them that they self-publish and then try to build a market? Would you suggest that they do print on demand and try to build a market or go directly to a mainstream publisher? So if you could just tell us how you landed your publisher and what advice you would give to new writers who are trying to find a publisher.
Well, one thing about it, when I do talk to people and they say, oh, I'm not going to pay anybody to publish me, or I'm not going print on demand, I know I can get picked up. A lot of times your story will be outdated before someone even reads it. I'm an advocate of self-publishing. I'm an advocate of print on demand if you find someone that's reasonable. When I started print on demand, iUniverse was $99. Okay? So, yeah, I went print on demand. That way I didn't have to design my books. I didn't have to format my books. I didn't have to get an ISBN. I wasn't really trying to get rich. I wanted my books out there. Mm-hmm. Now with the price of print on demand, it's just a little under self-publishing. So I would say self-publish so you can keep all of your own creative control. Print on demand is easy. If you can't self-publish, print on demand. That's my only – I don't have any qualms about print on demand so much as it's the ease. It's kind of like complex apartment living versus your own house. What do you want to do, mow your lawn or not? So
you said the price for print on demand, you started out, it was $99.
It was $99. I think it's gone up to like $700. I think it's gone up. That's how long, but it's been a long time. You know, it's been about 12 years, and because it got so popular. So with that price, I would say, you know, go to Lightning Source. There's a couple others out there, and I wish I knew the names, but I don't. And I've never used Lightning Source, so I'm just kind of speaking from other people's experiences. But I would kind of avoid houses that are a guaranteeing you publication. There's an in-between one. There's a print-on-demand where you pay them and they print your book. Then there's another one where you get all the control and you basically are self-published. You got to do all the ISBN work yourself.
Right.
Then there's that middle road, and I'm not going to mention those companies' names. I think that's unprofessional. But those that have used them, I think they're finding out that the books, even though they didn't have to pay, and they do feel that they're published because they sent in their book, they're accepted, and they published the book for them. The books are very high priced. The editing is kind of low end, and the marketing suffers because the book costs so much. You know, they're coming out with a book that should be $14 at $30 on the market, and you're a new author. Nobody's going to pay that for your book.
Yeah,
I mean, maybe your fans, maybe your first 100 friends, and you're going to feel like you did great. But after that, you know, with you want a book to where people are still talking about Majestic Secret. Book came out in 1997.
Mm-hmm.
That says something. If my book can stay $14 for for over 10 years, that's what you want.
Right.
You know, and then when your book comes out, if you're able to publish it yourself, get the knock the price of that book down so that people can get their hands on it.
Right. And I would say this, too, and you kind of mentioned, I don't know if you're talking about the same type of publisher. I'm thinking of what they call, there's a type of publisher they call a vanity publisher, where you actually pay the publishing house to publish your book, and the amount of money is very, very
high. It's exorbitant. It's like $30,000 to put a book out.
And then to recoup that money is not going to be easy at all. So if you just want to hold a book in your hands and say you published a book and you don't really, you just want to maybe share it with your family and your friends, then print on demand or self-publishing probably would be.
Or even going with an e-book, even getting the software to where you can do your own e-book. There's software out there where you can encrypt it to where you're not just sending out PDFs that can be copied and whatever. You're actually encrypting it to where only one person can download it without paying. You know, they have to order it from your website, pay you. You send them a code, they can download it, and then they can't copy that over. There is software that's not that awfully expensive where you can do that yourself. Mm-hmm. You know, you can go to the college and get an inexpensive editor. Most colleges that offer MFA also have a publishing program where you can go there, find a student who's got some time, pay them, who's studying to be an editor, to edit your book for you at a reasonable price. It helps them, it helps you. You know, just kind of get out there and network in your community with the college especially and get your book put together. Get a good presentation on your book. Go to their graphic designing course. Or there's a lot of authors out there that because of the economy, we've had to branch off and do secondary things like make book trailers and big websites. And I know one specifically, Sheila Goss. She's now doing graphic design. She designs book covers. Candace Cottrell, beautiful book covers. And so go out there, you know, get into the networks and find out who's doing what. Get a good cover for your book. And even with ebooks, you need a good cover. Because once people download and print those books, they're going to print the cover too.
Right.
And then do an ebook.
That is a good way. Ebooks are becoming more and more popular. Of course, nonfiction in print or electronic form is the number one seller, and then I think romance, and then the other fictional books follow, probably series books next, and then so on from there. But ebook is a good way to get out there and to start to get noticed. And after you build a good reader base, then you could get the ear of an editor or a publisher at a mainstream. I wanted to ask you, Michelle. A lot of people sitting back, as we come down to the last few minutes, but a lot of people sit back and they think, wow, man, I'm going to get me an editor and a literary agent and a publisher, and I'm going to be sitting.
And a whole bunch of money.
Yes, that could be a dream, and my books are going to be made into movies, and I'm going to be doing like J.K. Rowling and Stephen King and Toni Morrison and Terry McMillan. I'm going to be living a good life. I wanted to ask you, when you do get a mainstream publisher, because writers think about these multi-city tours, they have you in these five-star hotels, you're meeting these wonderful people. Is that realistic, and have you had to continue yourself to market and promote your books, or does the publisher do all that work for you?
For new writers out there, that's a great goal, and you should keep it. It's just like being the little boy that says, I'm going to be president when I grow up.
Okay.
You should keep that as a goal, and you should work towards that goal because it's a goal, and with any goal, you're going to have to work hard at it. Yes, I've been sponsored by book clubs, and they've brought me out to Arizona, or they've brought me out to New York, or they've brought me to Atlanta. That's great. In this economy, it's very hard, and groups have a harder time getting together the money to send for an author who isn't Toni Morrison or Eric Jerome Dickey. They just don't send for B-listers that much anymore. You kind of have to work around your general area. And when I use the term B-listers, trust me, when you come into this market, unless you are J.K. Rowling, or you hit on a something big, you know, you're going to stay on the C list until you move up to the B list, and you're going to stay on that B list a really, really long time. And and that's just the way it is. A-listers are they're not as many out there as you think, and that's why you see these repeated names over and over and over, because it's a very tight market niche to get in. And those are the ones who the publisher puts the most money in, because it is a business. And B-listers are kind of like the potatoes and the carrots to the roast beef. We're needed, and without us, we're missing. But, you know, sometimes, you know, as you heard people go, oh, I forgot the yams, and everybody got through eating. That's kind of, you know, we're the backup when they go, man, I'm still hungry. Well, there's always room for Jell-O, and they bring out a Michelle McGriff book. You know, it's like, and it's okay. We get to be part of the meal. That's okay. But if you go in thinking that that's going to be your literary life, you're going to burn out really fast. You're going to get so tired. Mm-hmm. You have to write for the love of it. And don't, like the old saying, don't give up your day job. If you want to give up your day job, that's fine. If you're making it, I happen to live in a place where I write full time. But I do have to have a multiple stream. I can't just live solely on what I make from my books. Because I'm in academia, I'm also a freelance writer. Hone your craft. If you're going to write, write. Write for your living. Write for your job. Write for your income. Write for, you know, expand your writing life if that's what you want to be. And that will help you get to where you're trying to be. You may find yourself on tour as a lecturer more so than a writer. You know, you just never know because the industry has so many different facets in it. You may get out there thinking you're going to be a writer, and you may end up being a screenplay writer and writing a movie. You never know.
You know what? That is very – and I appreciate the fact that – and I'm sure our listeners here at Off the Shelf who are thinking themselves, man, I'd like to be where Michelle McGriff is. I'd like to have – all those books that she's published, I'd love to be there myself as they can listen to how you went from print on demand to a mainstream publisher. They would like to do that progression just the same way that you have, and you're going after your PhD, and you're also a freelance writer. I really appreciate the fact, though, that you said keep that dream. If you have that dream of doing those big, those multi-city book tours, and of really making it big as an author, I really appreciate that you didn't say to off-the-shelf listeners, that's never going to happen, that you said keep that dream, keep that goal, and be open to developing as a writer also in other areas. Another writer, and I don't know why her name just escaped me. Oh, Maxine. I know you know Maxine.
Oh, yeah, she's my agent.
She's a big multiple stream type writer.
Yes.
Herself, you might, your novels alone might not pay all the bills. They may certainly help pay some of them, but then the
as I say, she's an agent also. She found out she's good at being an agent. So she's an author and an agent, as well as an academic writer. She's also a PhD and writes, she does academic writing. So she's been able to make her living in different areas of the literary field.
And kudos to her and to you, to both of you guys. I wanted to ask you, Michelle, before we go, are you working on any new material? I know you said you have a book that when you were talking, you were like, and I think the character is going to, and it didn't seem like it was a finished or complete book yet. Is there a new book that our listeners here at Off the Shelf should be looking
for? Well, Swerve's going to be coming out in late November, early December. I do have a pen name, Lena Scott, and I write urban books for that pen name, and that book's coming out in September. It's the West End Girls series, another series. It's book two of the West End Girls series. And then I'm also working on some nonfiction things, such as a cookbook, and that's my website, www.theveganwriter.com. And a lot of authors are starting to put in their weight loss stories, and I've got two finally that contributed a story to me about their weight loss adventure as a writer, because most writers pick up weight because we're just sitting there. And I'm talking about getting healthy as a person who has a sedentary lifestyle. And so that website's starting to pick up a little bit in interest, and it's going to develop. I'm putting recipes in there. If you got a recipe, Denise, send it to me. I'm putting authors' recipes in there, and it's going to be an author's cookbook, just how to eat healthy and how to live healthy in a sedentary lifestyle.
Interesting. See, man, you're the way your mind works. I've never even heard of a cookbook simply with writing. I hope that takes off for you, Michelle. I truly do. I hope it.
Well, I lost 50 pounds, so that's what I do. I do have pictures of me up there.
Oh, my goodness. Wow.
And so I'm kind of doing that. Well, so did Tina McKinney, and so did Gail Jackson Sloan. We're authors who've been able to say, you know what, this sitting here isn't doing it for me. I've got to get this weight off. And we've got pictures up of our weight loss. And, I mean, they've just contributed their pictures up there, how they look now. I'm going to put some before and after up there. And just, you know, those recipes up there of how to live healthy. And I'm vegan, and so that makes it, you know, that's why it's the Vegan Writer.
Oh my goodness! That's awesome to have lost 50 pounds. We are now actually at the end of our interview with Michelle McGriff. It went so fast. I want to thank Michelle McGriff. She is a best-selling author. Please go visit her online at www.michellemcgriff.com. Her interview will be in the archives, so you can come back and listen to it again and again, get the tips and the encouragement that she has shared with us today, and learn more about her books. And please go visit her online at www.michellemcgriff.com and look for Swerve and like the November, December. Look for Swerve at our website.
Pre-order it. You can pre-order it now. Yep, you can pre-order it
okay.
now off Amazon.
Go over it and pre-order it and look for it at Amazon.com and bookstores everywhere and go grab it and pick up a copy. She does write interesting, intriguing, and engaging stories. And check out her website so you can keep up with what she's other interviews that she has, book signings that she has coming on in the future. Next week, next Saturday at 11 o'clock here at Off the Shelf, we will have best-selling romance author Frances Ray. So excited to have her coming on right after Michelle McGriff, two best-selling authors on here on Off the Shelf, back-to-back. Thank Michelle again for being here with us today. Thank you to each of our listeners for tuning in. Look forward to seeing you here same time, same place, next Saturday at 11 o'clock at Off the Shelf. Remember that you are truly loved, so valued, and incredibly blessed. Thank you for being here with us. Go out and create a marvelous day for yourself. Bye for now.
You too.
Michelle, shoot your email.
Okay, bye-bye.